Welcome to the Bible teaching ministry of Dr. Ron Jones. Our prayer is that God will use His Word to change your life and fill your heart with hope. And now, here's Ron.
The kind of prejudice and bigotry that leads to hostility against Jewish people is called, say it with me, anti-Semitism. That's right. Anti-Semitism tends to rear its ugly head in just about every generation, and you've probably noticed it's in the news again. Recently, the United States House of Representatives passed a resolution condemning anti-Semitism and other forms of hatred following days of debate over some comments that a freshman congressman from Minnesota made that some lawmakers believed were anti-Semitic. The resolution passed along party lines, and for a whole host of reasons that were politically controversial, it passed that way. But it was a reminder that, according to the History Channel, anti-Semitism is history's oldest hatred. That's the History Channel who says that. It's no secret to us that the Nazis perpetrated the most extreme example of anti-Semitism in what is known as the Holocaust. We remember from history, very near history to us, that during World War II, Hitler's, get this, final solution to the Jewish problem, that's what he called it, makes the hair on the back of my neck raise up. Final solution to the Jewish problem, Adolf Hitler said, and that led to the extermination of more than 6 million Jews. Hatred of the Jews did not start with Adolf Hitler. The roots of anti-Semitism travel far into ancient times. Again, according to the History Channel, they say, in much of Europe throughout the Middle Ages, Jewish people were denied citizenship and forced to live in ghettos. Anti-Jewish riots, called pogroms, swept the Russian Empire during the 19th and early 20th centuries, and anti-Semitic incidents have increased in parts of Europe, the Middle East, and North America in the last several years. The term anti-Semitism was first popularized by German journalist Wilhelm Marr in 1879 to describe hatred or hostility toward Jews. The history of anti-Semitism, again, this is the History Channel, the history of anti-Semitism, however, goes back much farther. Hostility against Jews may date back nearly as far as Jewish history. In the ancient empires of Babylonia, Greece, and Rome, Jews who originated in the ancient kingdom of Judea were often criticized and persecuted for their efforts to remain a separate cultural group rather than taking on the religious and social customs of their conquerors. And that last paragraph from the History Channel brings us all the way back to Daniel chapter 8. Because here the History Channel mentions that the roots of anti-Semitism go all the way back to these major world empires that were prophesied in the book of Daniel, starting with the Babylonian Empire, followed by the Medo-Persians, the Grecian Empire, then the mighty Roman Empire. And you can find anti-Semitism raising its ugly head, rearing its ugly head in every world empire, in every generation, even up to our modern times, even up to last week's news cycle. Interestingly enough, as we take a look now at Daniel chapter 8, the focus, the prophetic focus of the book shifts to the nation of Israel. We know that in part because in the original text, in Daniel chapter 8 through chapter 12, it returns to the Hebrew language, all right? From about the middle of chapter 2 through the end of chapter 7, Daniel uses Aramaic, which was the language of the Gentiles. And that was because the focus of the prophecies had to do with these major world Gentile empires that I mentioned just a few moments ago. Now the focus shifts to how these major Gentile empires will impact the Jewish people from the time of Daniel all the way to the end of the age. And Daniel chapter 7 through 12, you may remember, there are four specific visions that Daniel receives. He received these during the same historical time frame that is covered in chapters 1 through 6. But in chapters 1 through 6, Daniel was interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He was interpreting Belshazzar's handwriting on the wall. But also during that time, over about a 22-year period of time, Daniel received four specific visions from the Lord. He records them in chapters 7 through 12. Chapter 8 is the second of four visions, and it happens about 2 years after the vision recorded in Daniel chapter 7, and we can pinpoint that time to around 551 BC, all right? About 500 years before the birth of Jesus Christ. And in this vision recorded in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel sees a ram, a goat, and a little horn. Sounds kind of crazy, doesn't it? Sounds like something from Alice in Wonderland, but no, this is not, you know, fantasy, or we're not going to run into unicorns and fairy dust and all of that. Bible prophecy and the visions like of which Daniel received were highly symbolic. And the good news is that we don't have to guess as to what this ram and this goat and this little horn are, because two heavenly messengers interpret this to Daniel later in the vision. But in Daniel chapter 8, Daniel also receives more detail about the second and third empires, the Medo-Persian Empire and the Grecian Empire, and how they will impact the Jewish people. Of particular interest is the rise of a little horn in Daniel chapter 8, a ruler in the latter period of the Greek Empire, this ruler that unleashes unprecedented anti-Semitic terror against the Jews. This little horn, keep in mind, is different in Daniel chapter 8 than the little horn in Daniel chapter 7. They're different, but they're similar. They're different, but they have a relationship. The one in chapter 7 is, of course, the Antichrist, and the one in chapter 8 becomes a foreshadowing of the ultimate Antichrist to come. The little horn of Daniel 8 is a hate-spewing ruler from the Maccabean period, a ruler that arises in the Greek Empire toward the end of the Greek Empire, known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Probably a guy you've not known or heard mentioned in history, let alone Jewish history or even Bible history. But he's an important figure, even as we understand the role of the Antichrist at the end of the age. C.I. Schofield said, "The little horns of Daniel chapters 7 and 8, though different people, have this in common. They are alike in their hatred of the Jews and of God and in profaning the temple." Now, with that in mind, let's take a closer look at Daniel chapter 8. Beginning in verse 1, Daniel says, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me after that which appeared to me at the first, and I saw in the vision. And when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased, and he became great." Daniel, in this vision, sees himself in the citadel city, the capital city of Susa. Now, Susa was an insignificant city at this time. This is around 551 BC. Insignificant city, but as time goes on, Susa will become a significant city in the Persian Empire. And if you know your Old Testament Bible and the books of Esther and Nehemiah, Susa comes into play. Susa was a significant city. Remember, Nehemiah was in the capital city of Susa serving as cupbearer to the king when God burdened his heart with the broken down walls of Jerusalem, and he gets permission to go back to Jerusalem and survey the area. And you know, that's the whole story of the book of Nehemiah. God knew long before Daniel knew, long before even the Medo-Persian Empire comes into play, that Susa would become a significant Persian city. And Daniel is standing there on the bank of a canal, and he sees a ram. nothing unusual about that, except that the ram had two horns, and one grew higher, though slower, than the other. Now, we could sit here all day long and speculate and say, oh, the ram means this, and the horns mean this, and all of that. But scroll down to verse 20, to a section of chapter 8, which includes the interpretation from the two holy messengers that are there on the canal with Daniel. And verse 20, one holy messenger says, as for the ram that you saw with the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. All right, there you go. The ram and the two horns. The ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire, and these are the two kings that arose. We know from history that the Medes arose first, and later the Persian king gained control. Thus the picture of the two horns and one horn slower to grow, but growing higher than the other. The mighty Medo-Persian Empire that overcame the great Babylonian Empire, there was no empire as large. The world had never known an empire as large as the Medo-Persian Empire, and that is descriptive there in the vision. But we read on in verse 5 and following that in addition to a ram, Daniel sees a goat. Verse 5, as I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. Imagine that picture, just kind of floating across the ground, this he-goat. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. The ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. There was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was great, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. If the holy messengers interpreted the ram for us, maybe they also interpret the goat for us. And in fact, they do. Scroll down to verse 21. And the goat is the king of Greece, and the great horn between his eyes is the first king. Who do we know this to be from history? Remember, this is prophecy from Daniel, all right? But from history, from our perspective, we know this to be Alexander the Great, the first king of the Grecian Empire. The Grecian Empire overtook the Medo-Persian Empire in 331 BC. Daniel is receiving this in 551 BC about an empire that will arise and take over another empire, and a king that will arise that will be like a goat that floats across the earth. The conquests and the exploits of Alexander the Great are well detailed in our history books, and the speed with which his armies went across this earth, pictured here as a goat that just floats across the earth. He's so fast. And Alexander the Great and the great mighty Grecian Empire conquered all the known empires of the world at that day. Historians tell us that Alexander was sad that he had no more kingdoms to conquer. And at the ripe age of 33, he died of a fever unexpectedly. And history also records that four of his generals took his empire, broke it into pieces. All right? Isn't that what the prophecy said hundreds of years earlier? The goat became exceedingly great, but when he was strong, the great horn, who was Alexander, was broken. Yeah, he died. Alexander died at 33. How does a young man like that conquer the world? God prophesied it. God made it possible for Alexander to do this. But it says, the great horn was broken, and instead of it, there came up, this is verse 8, four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Yeah, the four generals of Alexander, we know from history, fulfilled this prophecy, broke up his kingdom into four parts, and went on from there. We read on in verse 9 about the third kind of strange character in the vision here, not only a ram and a goat, but now a little horn. Verse 9, out of one of them, out of one of these four conspicuous horns. Out of the line of one of the generals, okay, out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host, and the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. This little horn changes the religious traditions of the people he's oppressing. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." This little horn arises long after the Medo-Persian Empire overtakes the Babylonian Empire, and the Grecian Empire overtakes the Medo-Persian Empire, and down the line comes a little horn, a ruler that is one of the most anti-Semitic, hate-spewing kings that the Jewish people ever had to deal with. And there's general agreement that this is pointing to a figure in Bible history and in Grecian ruling history known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Probably a name you haven't heard before. But he ruled over Greece from 175 BC to 164 BC, 11 years of a reign of anti-Semitic terror on the Jewish people. I find it kind of interesting that the Lord calls him a little horn. Even the Antichrist of chapter 7, just a little horn. Isn't it true that the littlest guys sometimes bark the loudest, right? Oh, make no mistake, Antiochus Epiphanes and the future Antichrist of which he is a foreshadowing, they made a big noise, that little horn did. But from God's perspective, he's just a little horn. Just a little bitty horn over here that arises up. Donald Campbell writes in his book about Daniel, he says, there is general agreement that he is Antiochus the fourth Epiphanes, eighth in the line of successors from Seleucus, and that he reigned in Syria from 175 to 164 BC. Thus, the prophecy, follow the timeline here, skips from 301 BC, the time of the division of Alexander's empire, to 175 BC when Antiochus Epiphanes became king. Are you still with me? Some of you are saying, "I didn't do very well, Pastor, in high school history with all these dates and these timelines." I understand that. Hang in there. I promise you, this is more than just boring history. This is Bible prophecy. But there is a connection to the time of the end and a connection between the Antichrist at the end of the age and this figure known as Antiochus Epiphanes. Understand, Daniel received this vision, again, in chapter 8 in about 551 BC, and it takes us to the little horn hundreds of years later, to 175 to 164 BC. This is a significant period of time. It's the time between the Testaments. The 400 years of silence, we call it, between the Old Testament and the New Testament, between the last prophet of God who brought a word from God to the people of Israel and said, "Thus saith the Lord." The time between that and the birth of Jesus Christ in Bethlehem was 400 years. Generations passed, and all they had, all the Jewish people had, were the promises of God. Not even all of this. They had a portion of this to hang on to and hope. Hope that the Messiah would come. Hope that God still had a plan for the nation of Israel. And it was in that time that Antiochus Epiphanes, the little horn, arises, and he is a hate-spewing, anti-Semitic leader. Look again at the description, beginning in verse 23. "And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. His power shall be great, but not by his own power, and he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. By his cunning, he shall make deceit prosper under his hand, and in his own mind he shall become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many, and he shall even rise up against the prince of princes, and he shall be broken, but by no human hand." The power that this little horn has is not his own power. And when this little horn is broken, it's not by a human hand. Remember, God sees to the rising and to the fall of kings and kingdoms, and that was true of Antiochus Epiphanes as well. His job description, we might call it, sounds a lot like the Antichrist to the little horn of chapter 7, doesn't it? But we know from this period of time and from history, and again, there's general agreement that this prophecy about the little horn in Daniel chapter 8 that came to Daniel in 551 BC was fulfilled in part by Antiochus Epiphanes in 175 to 164 BC. During that time, Antiochus imposed Greek culture and religion on all of his subjects, including the Jews. Again, Donald Campbell writes, it became unlawful to read the Torah. Can you imagine living in a country where it was unlawful to read the Bible? But this was the oppression that came against the Jews. It was unlawful to read the Torah, to observe the Sabbath, to practice circumcision. All of their Jewish traditions became unlawful under Antiochus Epiphanes. Those who disobeyed these edicts were massacred. In one assault on Jerusalem, 40,000 Jews were killed in 3 days, and 10,000 more were taken into captivity. And this seems to be the allusion in verse 10, and possibly even an allusion to what the writer of Hebrews was talking about in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 35 and 38, a time of great oppression for the people of Israel. Now, how is this more than just a history lesson? It all pivots around this phrase, the time of the end. From Daniel chapter 8 to the end of the book of Daniel, this is a common phrase, and it has technical meaning to it. It starts in chapter 8 and verse 17, where it says, Daniel says that he, that is one of the holy messengers, came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. Daniel, this vision about the ram and the goat and the little horn, it's a vision about the time of the end. You go on to chapter 8 and verse 19, you see the phrase, the time of the end. You see it again in chapter 11 and verse 35 and verse 40, chapter 12, verses 4 and verse 9. And it always refers to the time of the end just prior to the second coming of Jesus Christ and to the ultimate reign of terror upon the Jewish people that will come via the Antichrist who rises to power at that time. So why again do we point to Antiochus, or why was Antiochus not the ultimate fulfillment of this? Because we know in part that Jewish suffering did not end when Antiochus Epiphanes was put down. You know, we can just look back at the early 20th century and to the Holocaust under the Nazis and know that the time of the end of Jewish suffering had not come. So Antiochus Epiphanes becomes a foreshadowing. And a lot of times in Bible prophecy, you have a near-term fulfillment of a prophecy, and then you have a later fulfillment of that prophecy, and that's what we see here. Let me put a chart up on the on the screen here to show you what I'm talking about. The prophecy to Daniel came in 551 BC. The near-term fulfillment is in Antiochus Epiphanes, this hate-spewing anti-Semitic ruler who oppressed the Jewish people in 175 to 164 BC. And his reign of terror came to an end. I'll get to that in a moment, but Antiochus Epiphanes becomes a foreshadowing of the later fulfillment of the Antichrist at the end of the age. Now, in 164, and again, this is a period of time in Bible history between the Testaments. We're in that period of time, that 400 years of silence. And in a period of time where there were some writings that were not canonical in nature. What do I mean by that? They never made it into the canon of Scripture, but they give us some insight into history. They were not inspired writings, and I won't go into all the detail as to how church leaders and spiritual leaders over the years have determined the 66 inspired books of the Bible. But there are some books that were written during that time known as the Apocrypha. If you come out of a Catholic background, you'll find in a Catholic Bible more than 66 books. They include the Apocrypha, part of which is 1st and 2nd Maccabees, okay? Good history books, probably not inspired, meant for the text of the canon of Scripture, according to our Protestant way of thinking. But 1st and 2nd Maccabees tells the story of Judas Maccabeus, who led what was called the Maccabean Revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes. After 11 years of his reign of terror, the Jewish people had had enough, and they put down Antiochus Epiphanes. And the Maccabean Revolt took place, they date it to around 164 BC on December 25th, which ironically is when the Jewish people celebrate Hanukkah. Hanukkah is in remembrance of that Maccabean revolt against this hate-spewing, anti-Semitic Grecian ruler known as Antiochus Epiphanes. And the vision, though, was for the time of the end. Before we get to the time of the end, let's just think about what was happening in history during this time. A dark time in Jewish history. A dark time in the sense that it was between the Testaments and they hadn't heard a word from God for, you know, a couple of centuries by now, and it would go on for another 150 to 70 years before the time of Christ. Here's the lesson that we learn from all this. It's always dark before the dawn. This was a really dark time in Jewish history. Just such oppression, such hatred, such anti-Semitism, such a reign of terror that came from Antiochus Epiphanes against God's chosen people. But it came at 11 p.m. before midnight, right? Or just before the midnight turned, or just before the dawn, or it's always darkest just before the dawn. I didn't get my time frame right there, but you know what I'm talking about. In the larger time frame, you know, this was the birth of Jesus and the coming of Messiah was right around the corner. It'll be the same way at the end of the age. It'll get really, really dark on planet Earth. The rapture of the church will take us believers out of this earth, and then the Antichrist, who Antiochus Epiphanes is a foreshadowing of, will come onto the world scene, and for 7 years, especially the last 3.5 years, hateful, anti-Semitic unleashing will take place like the world has never seen, and that will make Antiochus Epiphanes look like a Boy Scout. That's the idea here. It's always darkest just before the dawn. There are some people who interpret Bible prophecy in such a way they think, oh, we're going to get better and better and better, and we'll get more and more Christ-like, and the kingdom of God will come to this earth, and then Jesus will come. That's not what the Bible teaches. That's called post-tribulation. Post-tribulationalism. I believe it gets darker and darker and darker until it gets really dark. The church is raptured. 7 years of the worst of times on planet Earth. You can read the detail of that time, Revelation chapters 6 through 19. The rise of the Antichrist and his world domination and rule. But that little horn is just a little horn from God's perspective, because Jesus Christ returns and defeats him. Okay? Then the time of the end of Jewish suffering comes. Not under Antiochus Epiphanes, but when Jesus Christ comes again, his second advent. Well, what do we do with a message like this? This series called Mysteries of Babylon is meant to show us how to prepare for the second coming of Jesus Christ. How do we do that? Let me suggest three things. Number one, trust Bible prophecy precisely. Bible prophecy is amazing in its precision. And I want to just go back to verses 13 and 14. When the two holy messengers, they're on the canal in Susa, are having a conversation, and one of them says, "How long will this suffering last?" And he says, "For 2,300 evenings and morning, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." This is probably in reference to the near-term fulfillment of Antiochus Epiphanes. It's interesting that the Jewish people date the first Hanukkah, December 25th, 164 BC. You go back 2,300 days and evenings, and you get to the beginning of the reign of Antiochus. The Bible is just amazingly precise that way. And you can always trust that God knows what he's talking about when it comes to the future. Secondly, bless Israel intentionally. What do I mean by that? My mind went back this week to Genesis chapter 12. Remember the story of Abraham or Abram at the time, and the Lord comes to Abram and says, "Abram, don't get too comfortable in retirement there in the Ur of Chaldees. I'm going to make a great nation out of you." The Lord goes to this childless couple, Abraham, who was 75 years old, and his wife Sarah, 65, beyond the childbearing years, and the Lord promises not only to give them a child, but to make a great nation out of them. 25 years later, Isaac is born. You think you're waiting on God for something for a long time. You know, the father of our faith, Abraham, you know, he waited for 25 years, as did his wife Sarah, and Isaac was born. Here's what the Lord said to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, "I'll bless those who bless you, and I'll curse those who curse you." It was out of the loins of Abraham and Sarah that came the Hebrew people and the nation of Israel, God's chosen people. And the promise from the very beginning was, "I'll bless those who bless you, and I'll curse those who curse you." You want to not only be on the right side of history and on the right side of Bible prophecy, you want to be on the right side of Israel and of God's chosen people. You know, one of the reasons Catherine and I go to Israel as often as we do, and there are many reasons to go, and I hope you can go with us next time, but we go in part to bless Israel. We bless them in two ways. First of all, we spend money in their economy. Okay, that's a blessing in and of itself, right? You go to that part of the world, and tourism is a huge part of the ancient world, and it's fascinating to be a part of that. But our presence there also blesses Israel. When Western Christians, and really Christians from all over the globe, go to visit the Holy Land and walk in the footsteps of Jesus and have their faith inspired, do you know that our presence just blesses the people of Israel? Because they don't have very many friends. And they live in a neighborhood nestled against the Mediterranean Sea, like, you know, just that part of your finger, small little country, and none of their neighbors love them. They don't even like them. Their neighbors want to wipe them off this planet like they've never existed. And that anti-Semitic hatred that rears its ugly head in every generation, the hotbed of it is right there in the Middle East. And when we go, just our presence, you know, we're one of the few friends that Israel has, and we're not even in their neighborhood. But it blesses them that way. I want to be on the receiving end of God's blessing. I want to be on the receiving end of that Genesis 12 blessing. "I'll bless those who bless you," the Lord said. So trust Bible prophecy precisely. Bless Israel intentionally. And finally, believe God's word emotionally. What do I mean by that? I mean with all of your heart. With all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Listen to Daniel chapter 8 and verse 27. This is Daniel's response to this vision. And if you want to know how you're to respond to it today or how I'm to respond to it today, look at verse 27. And I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it. You think you and I have a difficult time piecing together and understanding Bible prophecy? I mean, Daniel had just a fraction of the information that we have with the complete text of Scripture. He had a hard time understanding it, and he had two holy messengers interpreting portions of this. But this vision made him viscerally, emotionally, and even physically sick to his stomach to see the end of the age and the suffering of the Jewish people. He called in sick for several days. He just couldn't make it. And I wonder sometimes when we read our Bibles, you know, in our comfortable living rooms and our comfortable church chairs and all that, and we go, oh, that's very interesting. Nice history. I like that. I can now piece it all together. Ho-hum. We go back to our business. We don't respond to this like Daniel did. And if you've got a ho-hum Bible experience or response to this message, listen, get down on your knees with an open Bible and read this until it affects you. Until it affects you so much it changes the way you live. Until you stop putting your head down and just kind of doing what's in front of you. Until it affects you this way, and you lift up your eyes and you see that the fields are white unto harvest. And you lift up your eyes and you see the panorama of world history and Bible prophecy from God's perspective. And you lift up your eyes to see that Jesus is coming soon. And it affects you and me in every fabric of our being, every cell of our being, to where we just can't help ourselves to say, we've got work to do. This, we're not playing at this thing called church. The only reason we're on this earth is to introduce more people to Jesus Christ. Because Jesus is coming. Dark days are coming. It's our job to open up the pages of Scripture and warn an unbelieving world of the judgment to come. But in doing so, to introduce them to Jesus Christ. The Jewish people call Hanukkah the Festival of Lights because it was a time when they went into the temple that had been ransacked by Antiochus, and they found little oil lamps that they could use to light the lamps in the temple again. It went from a dark time to a time of light, a time of hope. Hope again was alive in their spirits, even though they had gone through a very, very dark time. I don't know what kind of time you're going through right now. Maybe you're going through a dark time. It's always darkest just before the dawn. God seems to work that way. He seems to lay it out that way, even in history and Bible prophecy. Just about the time you're ready to give up and say, there's no more hope, that's when hope is right around the corner. And just about the time we give up on this old world of ours and think that this world is just going to heck in a handbasket, no. Lift up your eyes and see our redemption draws nigh. And keep your eyes on the fields that are white unto harvest, and keep your hands on the plow, doing what we are called to do, which is to glorify God by making disciples of Jesus Christ who go and make disciples. Let's get after that, friends. We're not just playing church around here. Let's respond to this and ask God to give us the kind of response that even Daniel had to this vision, that just broke him to the core. You have my permission on Monday to call into your boss and say, I'm calling in sick today. I just heard the preacher's message on Sunday that I need to, okay?
You've been listening to the Bible teaching ministry of Dr. Ron Jones. For a complete list of resources available from Ron's ministry, visit somethinggoodradio.org.